is your favourite author if you're a reader? A reader of the classics, or are you into the new age stuff? Anyway, author was a title that used to be ascribed to someone who had experience at writing and had something to say. Now, everyone's an author. Just pick up your phone and onto Twitter you go, onto Facebook you go, rant away. Don't worry about the grammar, don't worry about the truth, don't worry about if anything's important in it, just say it, because you're an author now too. Grayson Quay, a Master of Arts student at Georgetown University, has written about this in an article entitled, Is Universal Authorship Such a Good Thing? And he joins me now. Grayson Quay, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you for having me, Amanda.
Well, do you write things on Twitter?
Yes, I do. I have a Twitter feed. I use it for a very bizarre mix of memes, jokes, random thoughts, and news articles. So it's a bit of a hodgepodge, but you know, as Shakespeare said, a poor thing but mine own.
Oh, well, I'm in exactly the same boat. Now, we were told that the internet was going to help spread the knowledge around the world, and I think it has done that. Let's not pretend that it hasn't. If you haven't visited a site called Open Culture or subscribed to it on Twitter, I highly recommend that you do, sharing lots of really, really interesting and good things. But cluttered in there are a range of comments from anybody and everybody about anything at all. And that, I think, is a bit like throwing mud, if you like, into the town square's debate. Is that unfair of me to put it that way?
Well, I really think you hit the nail on the head with what you said about how the internet was meant to kind of help us disseminate information and have these public dialogues. The CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, recently said in his congressional hearing that Twitter's meant to be this town square and promote healthy dialogue. And I thought to myself, well, if Twitter's meant to promote healthy dialogue, that's a laugh. But I think what happened is we sort of hit a wall at some point. You know, if you go back and you start with the Protestant Reformation and you look at the development of the printing press and, you know, the move toward universal literacy, you kind of see this idea developing that if everyone can read for themselves and really think and judge for themselves, and all the ideas are out there and available, that that'll create the best possible society. It's this idea called the marketplace of ideas, that naturally the truth and the best idea will rise to the top. And I think that worked for a long time. That worked while there were sort of barriers to entry. That worked right up until everyone had a mini publishing house right there in their pocket that they could use for free and with little effort. You know, for example, in the 1960s in the United States, we had three television news networks that everyone watched and everyone more or less trusted. Whereas now there's an infinite number of authors. You know, you have everyone from Alex Jones to Donald Trump to, you know, your aunt who has a Twitter account, all sort of vying for your attention. And I think what happens is this ideal democratic citizen who, you know, just carefully considers each point of view and picks one, that guy gets overwhelmed. I mean, I get overwhelmed. In my article, I talk about this writer for The Atlantic. I mean, this is his job, is to engage and participate in public discourse. And he's saying, I'm getting overwhelmed. I can't talk to everyone on the internet who wants to talk to me. So what happens is you kind of just, you know, you shut yourself off, become insular.
I think one of the difficulties is being able to tell just from the Twitter feed whether this person has got any brains or not, or anything informative to say. I mean, you can obviously you can tap on the photo and get what they say about themselves. But I mean, there's a journalist, described as a journalist in Australia, whose subtitles about themselves start with "Many fine opinions. Come and read them here." Well, you know, that's a self-proclamation of genius, I suppose. And you can tell if they say they're working at a university or whatever, but you don't have to work at a university to have a good opinion. So that means you can't really tell from that intro whether the person's got something useful to say. So it's very hard for the Twitter reader to see which department they're in. Am I in the department of clever people, informed people, thoughtful people? Am I in the department of a cheer squad for this side or a cheer squad for that side? It's not always easy to tell, is it?
Mm-hmm, exactly. And for a time, as I was saying, there were these kind of natural sort of technological barriers to entry. And those made it easier to say, you know, well, these opinions are fringe and extreme and ridiculous, and we're not going to let these in. So we will have a range of ideas, but it's not going to become a free-for-all.
Yes, that's right. It is a bit of a free-for-all, at least. As much as we might complain about media moguls, and I would complain about them, at least if you're writing a piece for a well-known paper or even the local paper, somebody else has made a decision about whether what you've got to say is worth reading. The editorial board or the editor or whoever, it's gone through a filter. There's no filter with social media.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, no filter whatsoever. And these are the discussions we're having in America right now. There were recently hearings in Congress where there was this question of whether to ban certain extreme people, most notably Alex Jones of InfoWars, from Twitter. And I think Alex Jones is a moron, but I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that we can sort of artificially erect these sorts of ideological barriers when there's no corresponding technological barriers. I think that, you know, we'd be trying to sort of shut the door after the horse is already out of the barn, so to speak. There's no way to stop universal authorship in its tracks except through some sort of massive program of government repression, something like what you'd see in China. And I'm not willing to make that trade-off.
No. I'm talking with Grayson Quay, Master of Arts student at Georgetown University in the United States. And we're talking about universal authorship. Is it a good thing that everyone can have their say anytime, any day? So there's really a magic bullet in relation to anything, but is there any policy change that could be made without being some draconian authoritarian interference in social media? Is there any policy change we could make that would improve this?
I'm not sure, honestly. I'm afraid of sounding like too much of a pessimist here, but as far as I can see, the trajectory just continues moving in the direction of greater proliferation of voices, which I think will result in people becoming more insular and kind of more ingrained in their own prejudices. I think that what we're looking at is a future that's sort of made up of these, to use Neal Stephenson's phrase from his excellent sci-fi novel, The Diamond Age, these sort of enclaves that are based on ideology and based on identity rather than being based on any kind of attempt to create a pluralistic nation state. I don't want to say that Twitter is going to destroy pluralistic democracy, but it's certainly a trajectory I see moving. I'd like to be able to say that the solution is just for everyone to try to understand other perspectives, but I mean, you try to do that for 2 days and you're burnt out. There's just too much.
Well, you can't listen to every perspective because there are so many, but you mentioned about prejudices before. What's this story about Russell Kirk and his assertion that prejudice isn't bigotry?
So he says that prejudice can transform into bigotry if you allow it to do so, and that obviously Russell Kirk is not a fan of bigotry, nor should anyone be. I know I'm certainly not. But prejudice, he says, just means prejudgment. He says allowing your intuition or the traditions in which you've been raised to kind of make a decision before you have a chance to think through the issues. And obviously that's become a very dirty word. And for good reason. I mean, bigotry has caused untold harm in pluralistic societies especially. But just seeing all these ideas out there, I think everyone's developing prejudice as just sort of a defense mechanism. Not in the sense of even necessarily being against someone for their skin color or their sexual orientation or anything like that. Just in the sense that maybe you see certain words or a certain turn of phrase or the name of a certain website and you immediately think, oh, that's an example of this ideology. You know, this person's a communist or this person's a misogynist, or you immediately conclude that this person has nothing to say to you, that this person's not worth taking seriously. You don't even need to read the whole article. You know, you read the headline and, you know, you jump right in the comments section and start yelling.
Yep.
So I think that as universal authorship progresses and as this information proliferates more and more, that people just get burnt out and they rely more and more on their prejudices to keep from simply drowning in information.
So in a sense, if you look back and say, well, when we first got books and the capacity to communicate across large numbers of people, literacy spreading, then ideas were able to spread. And what happened in the marketplace was ideas. A whole lot of dictators bit the dust and we came into the new age. So that leads one to think, well, that's a good thing, isn't it? When everyone can read and write and you can transfer ideas and there's an exchange of ideas and good things will therefore happen. But what seems to be happening now, and it might be, as you say, because there's no technological limits now on who can put themselves up as an author, that instead of, when I say simple ideas, I don't mean stupid, I mean clear, precise ideas being debated in the town square. Now we're throwing into the town square almost millions of ideas every day, and no one, no normal citizen, has the capacity to A, look at all of those, and B, sift them and sort them and come to some sort of conclusion. But they're nonetheless bombarded with them. So that's leading people to, I suppose, if you say follow their prejudices, sign up to the Twitter accounts that they like, sit there listening to the stuff, reading the stuff that they understand and agree with, not because they want to be ignorant, but because it's just too hard to look at all the rest. What do you think of
that? Yeah, exactly. I like what you said, and I certainly agree about a lot of dictators biting the dust. You know, you have the printing press, and then very, very quickly, I think, within 100 years, you have the Protestant Reformation, which, you know, very quickly kind of breaks the monopoly of the Catholic Church on Christianity in Europe. And then within the next few centuries, you have the American and French Revolutions. And exactly, you kind of have democracy emerging as this worldwide force. So the kind of growth in literacy and the growth in authorship and this proliferation of ideas has consistently had the effect of undermining arbitrary authority and sort of traditional power structures. But I think that we're reaching a point where it's possible we might have gone too far in the other direction, where we started off fighting repressive power structures, and I think in the end we might wind up imposing them on ourselves.
Okay, one final question, just to put it around the other way. Do you think it's possible, with the rise of what some people call elites, I call them the management class, the derogatory attitudes of those groups or that group to people who haven't had the same education and opportunities has led them to feel disenfranchised, as if their opinion doesn't count, which of course in a democracy it does, and that those people see social media as a means for them to have their say where other people they don't know who will be listening? And in fact, if we had a managerial class and elites that listened more to the general population, where the general population felt as though their view was being taken into account, we wouldn't see so much rubbish on social media? In other words, are people using it to vent their spleen?
I think that's definitely a possibility, Amanda. I think there is an extent to which these people are venting their spleen on social media. I mean, just look at the recent election of Donald Trump, which was, you know, largely people venting their spleen in the ballot box. But at the same time, I think it's hard to scroll through your Twitter feed and maintain your faith in the virtuous masses, or at least in the masses as this group of highly rational democratic citizens. I think that people, you know, everyone from the most educated down to the people with very little education are all in the same boat here. I have more education than the vast majority of my countrymen, and I still find myself burnt out trying to engage with all these ideas. So I don't know that it's necessarily an attempt to vent spleen, more as an attempt to sort of just circle the wagons.
Could be. Well, I have to say, Grayson Quay, I thought Hillary's remark about the deplorables, and I still do think, was one of the most damaging remarks for democracy in the United States and in the Western world that I've come across in a long time. I mean, in a sense, she just articulated what a lot of people think, so it's not to blame her. But it crystallised this attitude of the managerial class. In any event, Grayson, you and I are going to have to chat another day. Grayson Quay, master's student at Georgetown University, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, Amanda.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. I hope you join me next week. By the way, thanks for your feedback. As you know, you can jump onto the ABC site, go to Radio National, and then follow the prompts to Counterpoint to leave us a message. Thanks for all the feedback about bananas. There was no banana recipe. Until next week, this is Amanda Vanstone saying ciao, ciao.